The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of 8 recordings from the retreat called The 4 Messengers and the Message, taught by John Yaffe and Bridget Rollins. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. John Yaffe began practicing insight meditation in 1999 and has been a co-leader of St. Louis Insight Meditation Group since 2006. John is a student of Matthew Flickstein and has served on the Mid-America Dharma Board of Directors since 2005. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Her mentors include Matthew Flickstein, Ginny Morgan, and Gloria Terania Ambrosia. Recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, Bridget shares the Dharma through classes, workshops, and retreats.
I beg your indulgence in that I would like to begin this talk with a short poem that I wrote. I mentioned that I wrote depressed teenage poetry as a depressed teenager. Well, I'm not done. At any rate, this is called One Instant, and it speaks right at our subject. I see death, and not in just one place, everywhere I look. Not so near, but likewise not so far away. I hear death's voice, not so loud, but clearly heard each time I pause to listen. You have all the time in the world, and not one instant to waste. So, it was short. So I did, I mentioned earlier that the topic of this talk is the messengers and the moment. And we've talked at length about what we mean when we speak of the messengers, but what do we mean when we speak of the moment? I was talking to a retreatant earlier who was asking kind of about that, and I was explaining that mindfulness and paying attention to the here and now does not mean an exclusive, sort of totally focused attention to now that has no context. It actually implies the mindfulness component brings in memory and a sense of context as to what's going on. So when we're being mindful, we are actually living in a space which inherits a certain degree of awareness about the past. We know who we are and we know what we're doing. We know we are being mindful. We know we are here paying attention to direct experience. And in a sense, there's an awareness there of the future because we have a sense of purpose in doing it. And I mentioned awareness as a kind of flashlight illuminating the space we're in. Think of it as a mag light that has an adjustable scope. So there are times we focus down. But the first thing we do, when you made a decision to come here to this retreat, you most likely reviewed what was going on in your life to say, do I have the luxury and the circumstances and the conditions in place to make it reasonable to go to a retreat? So you reviewed a certain amount of your past and you reviewed what was coming up in the future to say, yes, all of that is under control. It's safe to set aside. I do have a past. I do have a future, but I'm going to focus now on the present and give this to myself, an act of generosity to myself. But there is this sense of the past and future being part of that now. And I contrast that to the way a child is in the now, where a child who something bad happens to is trapped in the now because he or she doesn't have a sense of context that it's going to end or what's going to happen. Several years ago, I spent an evening babysitting for a 6-year-old girl. I think she was 6 or so. But she had older parents who had never left her, and I was with her. and she was unconsolable for almost the entire night. And I, you know, I was putting on my Buddha man costume and trying to offer her all kinds of wisdom to help her through. You know, I said, you're creating this yourself, you know. You know, if you want to suffer, that's your choice. You know. And she finally settled down, I'm sure because of everything I told her. Maybe not. But there was this point in time where, you know, we had settled down. We were watching a TV show or something like that. And I could see her remember that she needed to get back to suffering. It's like, wait a minute, you've tricked me. Yeah, so there was this sense of, I'm stuck and I want to be stuck and there's nothing else but stuckness and stuff. So that was her now. But we, with a little bit more child and early adult and later adult and older adult development behind us, bring context to that sense. So when we talk about what the messengers can offer us with respect to the moment, I think it's reasonable to say not only what do they bring us in the here and now context, but how does what we know about the future inform how we work with the past and also how we work with the future? Which may sound a little strange, but hopefully it'll make a little more sense as I get to it. At any rate, in a sense, now includes all time. We can choose to focus on the breadth of it or narrow down. But now, even when we narrow down, we do so because we have that broader context in mind. So now includes all time and, in a sense, is the fruit of all things past and the seed of all futures. That would be the context, that would be now in the context of karma. And Bridget alluded to it earlier when she was sort of in a cosmic sense referring to the history of the universe, you know, that things have been moving and newness has been arising for, what, 13.7 billion years? And it got us here. You did it. So, but all of that's there. And, you know, when we talk about, I was talking earlier about these mind moments of experience, I said there are proximate causes, and indeed there are. But the reason we talk about proximate cause as opposed to just cause is because everything led up to now, and in some degree. So we have these truths that we looked at from the messengers, the truths of impermanence, the truth of unpredictability, the limits of our control over things, our inevitable and certain mortality. What do we do with these truths? If resistance is futile, exhausting, and exacerbating, which I established in my earlier talk, what then can we do? What can we do that is actually wholesome and skillful? What do we do in the past, the present, and the future? Or what do we do with the past, the present, and the future? What do we do with these aspects or components of now? Many of you are familiar with the acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N. I associate it with Tara Brach. I don't know if she originated it, but it's certainly integral to her teachings. It's an acronym that describes a wholesome way of being with our experience, and it's recommended as a method of being with difficult experiences, difficult memories or fears. So the RAIN stands for recognize what's going on, allow it or accept it, recognize that it is indeed there. There is a truth to it, even if it's a truth to the extent that it's a mental fabrication about something. The I stands for investigate, which could be unpacked just a little bit. Investigation, you know, if you're watching CSI, it involves all kinds of lab equipment and stuff. Investigation in the Buddhist context involves not so much attacking it with the mind, although occasionally we do reflect upon it, but more than that, much more than that, it involves being present with it in the same sense that we adopt an object of meditation. Being present with it consistently and long enough that we get to understand its true nature, which is to say, that we get to see it manifest the traits of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and non-self or the impersonal factors behind it. So that's the investigation. And then the N stands for non-identification or non-attachment. Once we see that things are coming and going in the mind and are coming and going, especially for impersonal reasons, there's nothing to grasp. There's no reason to hold on to it. Now, I find the RAIN technique helpful, and I like it, but I want to go a little bit further because I want to talk not only about being with our experiences, but the actions, the intentions we form, and the actions we take to work with them, because I do want to get into that aspect of things. Alas, I do not have a nifty acronym for you. But my idea, which has RAIN embedded in it, is to consider our past and future and now with an interest in learning from it, which certainly includes that whole investigation process, preparing for it or preparing from it, meaning, given what we've learned, what do we do? You know, how do we change or how do we change our circumstances if simply being with it isn't suitable? And then this talk will focus on those two issues. The next two, which will be the topic of the last talk I give, is focused on forgiving it and letting it go. And the idea is that especially if it represents unfinished business, you can't really let it go until you resolve that unfinished business with it, which is what I'm alluding to when I talk about forgiving. So learning from it, preparing for it or preparing from it, forgiving it and letting it go. So what I want to do is sort of look at those characteristics, especially the learning from it and the preparing from it, in the context of past, future, and present. Present because that's where we'll land. I realize that typically you go past, present, future. But we'll go past, future, no, past, future, present. So, with respect to the past, what can we learn from it? What do the messengers tell us about what we have suffered in the past? They seem to point to the future. I mean, when we talk about aging, illness, and death, we think about it coming or happening to us, but there's a future directedness to our concern with it. But when we examine the messengers, what we find and what I suggested the Buddha drilled into when he talked about the First Noble Truth is we find those three characteristics: the impermanence of things and the impersonal nature of them and the unsatisfactory nature of them. So impermanence with respect to our past tells us that it's not eternal. And the less you hold on to it, the less you resist it, the more quickly it passes if it's difficult, or the more quickly you recognize that it's actually already passed. Because sometimes the only thing we're dealing with is what we're holding on to. How do we hold it? One thing to look for is the body talking to us about how we hold it. We know we're holding on to things when there's tension, where there's heat, when there's contraction. We hold the past when we hold it in anger or where there's resentments. We hold it in fear. We hold it in embarrassment and shame. And we hold it in the loyalty we maintain to people, places, and things who and which did not really earn our loyalty. In short, we hold on to the past in our conditioning, our recurrent patterns of thought and emotionality triggered by both external and internal causes and conditions. So when we look closely at the triggers, they're impersonal, but the conditioning makes it feel personal. Second, there's the impersonal nature of things, the not-self aspect that we can bring to the past. for some reason, as I came to this, I wanted to reach into 12-step phraseology. They have something in 12-step called the three C's. It's a motto that goes, I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. Or, if we're looking at the past, I didn't cause it, I couldn't control it, and I couldn't cure it. Failure to appreciate the impersonal nature of powerlessness makes us subject to believing stories about it. Stories about our personal powerlessness, stories about our not being good enough, about being a loser, about being bad or weak, and on and on. Stories we tell ourselves, stories we've picked up from others. Sometimes they've been forced on us, sometimes we've just scooped them up along the way. But seeing the impersonal nature of things helps us break free from false, and it's also important to recognize incompletely true, stories of responsibility. Thus, seeing the impersonal nature of things liberates us from guilt and shame. Once we realize this, integrated with impermanence, the idea that it's actually over for us, or that we have changed and it no longer has the power over it, over us that it once did, we realize that we are free and can heal, or already have healed, or even better, that we are in fact, and perhaps at the deepest levels of spirit, always have been unharmed from the very start. Once we feel free and unharmed, we can truly forgive. This applies even when the actions we are troubled by are our own. When the person to be forgiven is you, or in my case, me, we too are subject to impersonal causes and conditions. It's a conceit when we think, oh, those other people, they're covered by, you know, their stuff is, you know, they've been swept up, but I should be in control. And that's often what we do. We often create a sense of self that we hold to a vastly higher standard of conduct than anyone else we look upon. How could this not be true? The thing to learn from looking back at our harmful actions in the past is simply not to do them again. That's the whole Buddhist, you know, when you say to the Buddha, what's the value of the past? It's to examine it to see what was wholesome and what was unwholesome so that we can avoid doing what we now recognize as unwholesome and stick with what is wholesome. It's so simple, you have to repeat it for years to get it. Let it begin here. Not to do them again, to break free of harmful patterns of thought and behavior at the earliest moment of our recognition of them, our mindful awareness of the pattern. If we work at this, we catch these conditioned patterns of behavior and drop them earlier and earlier in the cycle of their arising. It's even possible to prevent the pattern from getting going at the very earliest instant before it's manifest to anyone whatsoever. We can avoid, for you know, we can learn, for example, to avoid triggering settings or people. And this is right effort. Right effort involves recognizing the unwholesome that has arisen and withdrawing our encouraging energy from it, and recognizing the unwholesome impulses before it's even arisen, and not water those seeds, so to speak. And there, obviously, there's a corresponding side of nurturing and sustaining what is wholesome when we see that, you know, when we catch ourselves doing something wholesome, stay with it. And when we feel an urge that we recognize as wholesome, nurture and sustain that. That is right effort. As Tarania would say, the Buddha really nailed it. And among the harmful patterns of thought and behavior we want to see and cease, going back to this issue of beating up on ourselves, is or are patterns of self-criticism, condemnation, and cursing. Cursing not in the sense of swearing at ourselves, but the idea of like this curse that you'll never get it right, you know, as long as you live, that kind of stuff. In the absence of resistance, unsatisfactoriness, the third state, third condition, is reduced or goes away entirely in the learning and mastery of clear seeing, investigation, and renunciation, by which we mean withdrawing our energy and unwholesome attention from these activities, from our reactivity. When we do that, the sense of self grows healthier, it grows lighter and more open, and readies for release. We feel better about ourselves, which is okay. It's fine and desirable. We do need to watch out for getting egoic about that, because that can be a problem as well. But basically, it's okay to feel better. So that's some thoughts about the past. We could, you know, I don't want to make this about that kind of work. Well, I guess, well, I will say one other thing about it, and that is that in terms of, oh, wait a minute. Never mind. I'm just going to go forward because I think I trust myself to come back to this point later. When we talk about the future, and here I'm going to be getting at the old age, illness, and death thing in the traditional sense, the kind of stuff that Bridget warned us about last night. We learn for it, we prepare for it, recognizing our mortality, and we forgive it and let it go on behalf of ourselves and others. So when we speak of learning from it, we're saying that while unpredictable, impermanence is a fact and mortality is inevitable. Since the length and final conditions of our life are unpredictable, we should, not in the sense of obligation, but in the sense of having the option or choice, we should come to recognize health and well-being as a gift and an opportunity, especially precious and not to be wasted because it is finite, which is sort of what that little poem of mine is, and saying we don't have instants to waste. At the same time, we shouldn't be shocked or aggrieved as we age and approach death. We want to prepare for it. In a general but nonetheless helpful way, we can prepare for death in three ways, touching on the wisdom, the mental training, and morality components that we find in the Noble Eightfold Path. We can cultivate wisdom. We can reflect on these truths and incorporate it into our practice. Recognizing and penetrating impermanence leads to the reduction, if not elimination, of craving and aversion, and the arising of equanimity. Deeply knowing impermanence and mortality helps us investigate and refine our priorities to bring them into harmony with these deep truths. So I suspect that if we, well, we've done exercises, Bridget and I both, in our Sunday night Sangha things, where you give people a piece of paper and says, okay, you have a year to live. What are you going to do by way of preparation? And then people get all busy, you know. You have a month to live. People get really, really busy. You know, what if you have a week to live? What if you have an hour to live? What if you have a minute to live? And things get simpler and simpler. And when you come down to it, and the things that we think are so important to do, we recognize they're really not. And we realign our priorities. Now, because we don't know the moment of our death, we're not saying it's a minute away or an hour away. But I think if we hang around here long enough, we know people who have died sudden deaths. And we know that our health and various circumstances are unpredictable. And if we really take this seriously, some of the frivolous stuff and some of the obsessive stuff we get caught up in becomes transparent to us. And we say, we really don't need to do this. I'll segue with just a personal story about this. The reason I'm on a tear about aging, illness, and death is because my fiance and I have reached a situation where there's just a lot of that going on. She has a mother who's 88 years old and has been in and out of hospitals and rehab and now needs constant care. And a lot of our friends are encountering very, very challenging circumstances. And I've been struggling with this a silly little obsessive behavior for years and years and years. I've been sort of a nut about investing my retirement nest egg, and I've been on the computer managing my own money. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be, you know, the one who steers the ship of my future. And I, you know, I do all the stuff you do. And I, you know, when the investments go up, I'm thinking, boy, I really know this role. I'm really smart. Oh, boy. And then they go down. I go, oh, I'm a complete idiot, you know. And you know, I was just sort of tossed back and forth by these worldly winds. And I finally, you know, having gone through this last year of seeing death over and over again and illness and difficulty, I said, I am just wasting an incredible amount of time on this. And I finally called an investment manager, and I just turned everything over. And I'm not, you know, I don't do it anymore. You know, I'll look at it and see what's going on now and then. But I've got this tremendous amount of liberated energy and a mind that's free to be concerned with the Dharma or the people I care about in my life, instead of looking at this monitor and going like this all the time and, with the mouse. So I know from direct experience, and I'm sure you do as well, that if you look at these realities that are coming up and cannot be avoided, they can't be predicted, but they're coming, they allow you to put some things in perspective that really we will benefit from if we do. So, deeply knowing impermanence and mortality helps us investigate and refine our priorities and bring them into harmony with these deep truths. I don't have time to waste on that. Mental training. Practice meditation. Yes, in practice we learn to embrace now and cultivate acceptance and resilience in responding to whatever arises in mind. And we know this is valuable. But do we realize how valuable? Because there is an aspect of preparing for the future in that, not just in making us calmer and more sensible and clear-seeing people, but literally in preparing for death. There's one of the first eye-opening Buddhist books I read was the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And the Tibetan culture is a very different culture than ours. And they are much more invested in reincarnation and have a whole understanding of the journey involved with that, which I do not want to get into tonight. But in this book, they said something that made so much sense about the actual dying process and the role of meditation in preparing for it. What it described was that as we die, systems in our body are shutting down. They are not working as well as they normally did, and they are becoming disabled and are not working properly and are shutting down. If they weren't, we wouldn't be dying then, right? So this has to be happening. So in the course of that happening, there are metabolic processes which are not proceeding as they normally do. So it's reasonable, you know, this is posited, but it makes perfect sense, that there are metabolic toxins building up in the body. There's elements of our nervous system which are not clicking the way they should. We're not working as smoothly as we ought. And there are correlates of that that arise in our awareness. So people can become delusional or hallucinogenic or hallucinate. And things can come up, visualizations, experiences, emotions that are outside of the realm of our normal expectations can be coming up because stuff is going on in our body which is vastly outside of any normal activity that ever had going on before. If we have an untrained mind at that point, it's easy to react to those unexpected, predictable, but unexpected and perhaps very extreme experiences arising in the mind. And you could get into panic states or a variety of states which could make the dying process much more difficult and just make it harder to ever arrive at a point of peace with yourself and a place of comfortable letting go and allowance of this inevitable process. So in the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying explains that from the Tibetan view, and I think, again, not embracing their entire cosmic view, but it makes sense to look at meditation as training the mind in being non-reactive to whatever is arising in our experience. We teach this in the handling of the very subtle experiences that we encounter in the meditation process. We teach it when we talk to people about dealing with afflictive emotions. We say, okay, take what you learned in the meditation practice and apply it to fear or anger or whatever as it's arising in your day-to-day life. And you'll find it allows you to be more open to it, less painfully constricted in aversion to it, and allow it to move on. Well, we can say the same thing about how it helps you prepare for the dying process. It allows you to see what's going on more clearly in a non-reactive way, which has tremendous value, I should think. And the last point of the Noble Eightfold Path, just taking the sort of the three higher level aspects of it, is morality. So what does morality have to do with our planning in the future for death? For both our benefit and that of others, we can work through our wishes and our attitudes towards our death and do our best to anticipate our needs for long-term and final care and other aspects of care and the final distribution of our wealth and goods to those we wish. While we tend to think of morality primarily in terms of actions taken now or in the past, here we have an opportunity to plan our morality going forward by deciding in advance what level of care we want to receive if we get to the point where we can't make decisions for ourselves in real time, by talking this through with those with whom we want to entrust these decisions, and by taking care of the required legalities so that these people not only know what we want but are legally empowered to carry our wishes out. By doing all of this, we are putting both our own and others' minds at ease and minimizing later difficulties and stress. And from a spiritual perspective, morality is not just about what we do, it's about the way it eases and comforts our own mind. Because when we conduct ourselves in immoral ways, that would be fuel for the hindrance of restlessness to arise in our minds. And in this case, we're talking about preventive care for the future in terms of restlessness. This is a profound act of generosity. Working this up may seem morbid on first reflection, but it is genuinely wholesome and, like all moral and ethical actions, calming to the mind. So now if we move toward the present, there's a couple of ways to go here. We can work our way through the paramis, the traits we want to adopt to become Buddhas ourselves or work in that direction. We've already talked about renunciation, virtue. I've had a conversation this afternoon with a retreatant where patience became recognized as a very essential quality. So there's all of these, and you've had these lists before. I'll just go through it real quickly. But basically, having seen our priorities, or having understood the uncertainty of life and the value of life, given that uncertainty, we can renew our dedication to cultivating our journey on the spiritual path. The Buddha taught that this human life is inconceivably rare and precious. Bridget alluded to that earlier. We are animals with all the difficulty and limitations that living in the animal realm implies, but we are animals that have been blessed with a degree of consciousness and both a sense of self rooted in the animal and a degree of spirituality which can transcend it. Life has its trials, to be sure, so the blessings here can be hard to see sometimes. But the Buddha asks us to see them, and having seen them, he encourages us to cultivate and practice wisdom, morality, and mental training in the interest of liberating that spirit. That we cannot see either the what or when of what's coming, and yet know we are mortal. That we are blessed, and yet know that both these blessings and we ourselves are impermanent, tells us that every moment of existence is precious and should not be wasted. So the Buddha, one of his sutras, has him talking to his bhikkhus, his followers, about exactly this, about all the things that make this moment precious and the importance of recognizing it as an opportunity to practice. So he begins by saying, there is the case where a monk reminds himself of this. He uses the word himself, we could say herself. At present, I am young, black-haired, endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stage of life. The time will come, though, when this body is beset by old age. When one is overcome with old age and decay, it is not easy to pay attention to the Buddha's teachings. It is not easy to reside in isolated forest or wilderness dwellings. Before this unwelcome, disagreeable, displeasing thing happens, let me first make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. So that, endowed with that Dhamma, I will live in peace even when old. He goes on. And I think I'll honor what Bridget pointed out and actually go through. There's some repetitions here, but it's being repeated for a reason. Furthermore, the monk reminds herself of this. At present, I am free from illness and discomfort, endowed with good digestion. Not too cold, not too hot, of medium strength and tolerance. So he's saying, not only am I healthy, but my physical conditions are tolerable. The time will come, though, when this body is beset with illness, when one is overcome with illness. It is not easy then to pay attention to the Buddha's teachings. It is not easy to reside in isolated forest or wilderness dwellings or meditation halls. Before this unwelcome, disagreeable, displeasing things happens, let me first make an effort for the attaining as the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized, so that, endowed with the Dhamma, I will live in peace even when ill. Really, that's the same thing I was pointing out in that teaching from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Furthermore, the monk reminds himself of this. At present, food is plentiful. Alms are easy to come by. It is easy to maintain oneself by gleanings and patronage. We can adapt this to our lives. We're reasonably comfortable. The time will come, though, when there is famine. Food is scarce. Alms are hard to come by. And it is not easy to maintain oneself by gleanings and patronage. When there is famine, people will congregate where food is plentiful. There they will live packed and crowded together. When one is living packed and crowded together, it is not easy to pay attention to the Buddha's teachings. Interesting how he got to there from that. Before this unwelcome, disagreeable, displeasing thing happens, let me first make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized, so that, endowed with the Dhamma, I will live in peace even when there is famine. Furthermore, the monk reminds himself, herself, of this. At present, people are in harmony, on friendly terms, without quarreling, like milk mixed with water, viewing one another with eyes of affection. The time will come, though, when there is danger and an invasion of savage tribes. Taking power, they will surround the countryside. When there is danger, people will congregate where it is safe. There they will live packed and crowded together. He's really big on this packed and crowded together stuff. When one is living packed and crowded together, it will not be easy to pay attention to the Buddha's teachings. It is not easy to reside in isolated forest or wilderness dwellings. Before this unwelcome, disagreeable, and displeasing thing happens, let me first make an effort. All right, I'll keep reading. For attaining the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized, so that, endowed with the Dhamma, I will live in peace, even when there is danger. And surprisingly, and very honestly about the reality of his own circumstances and limitations as a great leader and the limitations of Sangha, he goes on to this last point. Furthermore, the monk reminds himself of this. At present, the Sangha, in harmony on friendly terms, without quarreling, lives in comfort with a single recitation. The time will come, though, when the Sangha splits. When the Sangha is split, it is not easy to pay attention to the Buddha's teachings. It is not easy to reside in isolated forest or wilderness dwellings. Before this unwelcome, disagreeable, displeasing thing happens, let me first make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized, so that, endowed with that Dhamma, I will live in peace even when the Sangha is split. These are the five future dangers that are just enough when considered for a monk, heedful, ardent, and resolute, to live for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. I'm going to finish by reading I'm not sure it's a poem exactly. It's certainly poetic. It's a section of a book called The Way of Solomon by Rami Shapiro. Very little book. There's a little bit of story narrative, but it's basically this exquisite translation of the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. Astoundingly beautifully translated with a lot of, Eastern understanding influencing the way, the approach to the translation. But this is called Reflection from Ecclesiastes. Before the light is harsh to your eye, before your eye dims to the glory of the sun, moon, and stars, before the clear sky seems clouded, before your limbs tremble and your back is bent, before your teeth blunt and your eyes fog, before your bowels tighten and your stomach slows, before your sleep is fitful and your ears seem stuffed with cloth, before the slightest incline seems like a great mountain, before the easiest task becomes a great challenge, before tumors threaten and boils erupt, before your spine twists and you cannot stand erect, before sexual desire fails, before your mind dwells on death and your friends appear as mourners, before your bones become brittle and your thoughts muddled, before your connection with this world is severed, and the dust of you returns to the earth, and the breath of you returns to the one who breathes us all, before all this, know the whole of life is empty of permanence. There is no certainty, no surety, no salvation to lift you out of impermanence. There is only doing without reward, serving without payment, learning without knowing, rejoicing without reason, loving without controlling, walking without map and measure. To think otherwise is to pursue the wind, and vanity piles upon vanity as you seek to freeze that which is forever melting.